Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Climate Week has come and gone with its high-profile protests, ambitious announcements, and inspirational speeches. What we are left with is the enormous challenge we face if we are going to get climate change in check. Part of what makes climate change such a hard problem to tackle is that it requires long-term thinking, something that we as individuals and as society seem to find particularly difficult. But why? Is it an innately human quality or something we've built into our institutions? And most importantly, can we change that? Those are some of the questions Bina Venkatraman sent out to answer with her new book. She's the director of global policy initiatives at the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard, a lecturer in MIT's Department of Science, Technology, and Society, and she advised the Obama White House on climate change innovation. Her new book is The Optimist Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. Bina, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you start the book with a very personal story that has nothing to do with climate change or other big societal problems, but about going for a hike and a subsequent health problem. And it's a story that illustrates our tendency toward short-term thinking, and I think it's a story a lot of people will relate to. So give us that story.
Sure. So a few years ago, I was hiking in the Hudson Valley in New York, just north of New York City, and I ended up the next day finding a rash on the back of my leg. It didn't look like the telltale bullseye you associate with a tick bite, but it turned out it was a tick bite. And I kind of ignored it because I didn't see that sign, even though it had swollen up and it was itchy and crimson. And it was only 8 months later, after ignoring it because I was working so hard and couldn't spare the time to go to the doctor, that my knee blew up and it was about the size of a grapefruit. And I had a really bad case of Lyme disease that took months to treat. It required me to go on IV antibiotics. And it was just an example to me of my own frailty, my own sort of neglect of warning signs, even clear warning signs. I knew that I was hiking in an area with a high prevalence of Lyme disease and ticks. I didn't even wear bug spray that day. But I think we're all kind of prone to this kind of thinking, which is to say that if you try to warn a teenage driver not to speed or tell someone, oh, don't date that guy because he's going to break your heart, right? We can see clear warning signs, but sometimes we can't exactly follow them. And that really extrapolates out to some of the biggest challenges we face as a society today. So if you think about climate change, for example, when I was working with companies from the White House, I was trying to persuade CEOs and corporate leaders to take action on a future of coming droughts and wildfires and floods. But so often I found that those executives told me that they'd like to do something, they cared about doing something, they cared about their children and grandchildren, but they just couldn't figure out how to plan ahead, whether it was because of how their boards and their shareholders evaluated them or just the day-to-day demands of their jobs. And that sort of set me off thinking, you know, is this really something that we have to accept as just innate in human nature, or is there a way to question it? Is there a way to change that proclivity we have to focus on what's right in front of us and ignore the warning signs? What I actually found through researching the Optimist Telescope, my new book, is that there are a number of ways in which we can actually reclaim this ability to think ahead. We can change environments. We can change institutions. We can actually make better choices than we're making today. And that's, to me, a source of hope.
Obviously, being able to make a choice, yes, that's a good thing. But we don't seem often to make that choice. And I wonder if you see today this age as a more reckless age than others. I mean, people worrying about reckless human behavior goes all the way back to Aristotle.
Sure.
We've been talking about humans being reckless for a long time.
Absolutely. It goes back to Plato, Aristotle. You're absolutely right. This idea that our inability to see the future leads to folly. I think the difference with our generation is the scope of the challenges we face and the knowledge we have about the future. So I think we need to be better than our predecessors, actually. We're being called upon, I think, to be better ancestors than our ancestors were because of the challenges we face, because we're living longer than our grandparents. We have a longer lifespan to think about just from our own personal point of view, and because of the way we're changing the planet.
Bina Venkatraman, in the Optimist Telescope, you say, and you've said here, that people often want to make the right choice. Even when we do think long term, we say we want to act on behalf of the future. We want to leave a better planet and a better situation to our children and grandchildren, and then we don't actually do it. So what did you learn about why? What is the disconnect there?
Right. And a great example comes from doctors, for example, who are steeped in medical knowledge about the consequences of the decisions they make in their practice. And when I studied the way that doctors prescribe antibiotics in situations where a patient's really desperate for an antibiotic or the doctor is really tired with the backlog of patients, what you find is that the same doctors who say they know it's inappropriate to prescribe antibiotics in certain situations to people who have coughs and colds and who don't really need them because it's going to be cleared up another way or it's a virus, that they'll still do it in those situations. And a lot of it has to do with scarcity of time or mental bandwidth to think about those future consequences and what I would call failures of imagination, inability to bring the present and future into proper focus and into proper perspective. When it comes to the future, we don't have that kind of sensory input. We don't have the visceral reaction to it. So we have to conjure it in our minds. It's a figment of our imaginations. And so what this tells us is that we need tools to better imagine those future consequences and that there are ways to gain those tools. For example, in the context of antibiotic prescribing, one of the things that's been found to work very successfully in the UK's health system, for example, is sending letters from high-profile British leaders to doctors and telling them when they're not prescribing at a very good rate, when they're prescribing inappropriately these antibiotics, and it changes the norms and sort of their expectations for their behavior. There's also ways to interrupt the moment of prescribing to help those doctors better imagine the future consequences, which are, by the way, superbugs that are growing to kill millions of people around the world. In the case of our individual lives and trying to make something like climate change more of a priority when we vote or when we think about our decisions or using our political power, it helps to do things like writing letters to the future, writing letters to someone 50 years from now, a child, a niece, a nephew, a godchild, yourself, and to take on the perspective of that imagined person in the future and try to put yourself in that place. So these are just some of the many tools that we need and can use that I write about in the book that help bridge that gap between what we think we know and our values, what we really want to be doing because we care, and what we actually end up doing.
Bina Venkatraman, in the Optimist Telescope, I really appreciated that it's not just an academic exploration of what has worked and what hasn't worked in the past, and there are lots of wonderful case studies. But there's also, at three different levels, pretty specific, like, how-tos. And you've already hit on some of these at the individual level, right? You could write letters to yourself. You could use VR to try to experience what a future with different choices might be like. But then you also take this on at higher societal levels, businesses and organizations, and then our communities and our whole society. What are some of the steps, perhaps, that individuals within their organizations or their communities could be taking right now to try to improve long-term thinking?
Sure. So one of the challenges in the business world is the way that value and progress are measured. So oftentimes we choose sort of metrics or targets that are reflections of the immediate term, like quarterly profits in a business, or let's say it's the number of meals served by a nonprofit. But those metrics are not always the true measures of what that organization is trying to achieve over the long term. And so one of the things that companies, that I found companies could do and investors could do, even people who are sort of individual investors, is to think about how to measure those, what you're doing, based on milestones instead of metrics. So looking at what are true reflections of value. Is something a real measure of whether a company is going to grow its market share or the loyalty of its customers, or is it merely noise in the immediate term? At the societal level and community level, a lot of what we need to do as individuals to affect those changes is to use our political power, hold our institutions accountable for looking at future issues, making those future issues a priority. But I have a lot to say to political leaders and others about how to better bring the future into focus. It includes things like using role play games instead of scenario planning so that you can take on some more of this imaginative empathy I was describing with the letter writing. It includes mending some of our institutional failures, including things like campaign finance reform, which often get in the way of leaders looking towards the long term.
When we think about organizations and a culture and a society that is, as a whole, better at long-term thinking, are there good examples that we can turn to? We certainly have examples of complete collapse of civilizations in the past because of failure for long-term thinking. Do we have good examples to turn to where long-term thinking has succeeded?
Well, I think uniformly across a society, you don't tend to see total long-term thinking. What I write about in the book is trying to create shared heirlooms. So in our families, many of us keep heirlooms or get heirlooms. And for me, I have a particular heirloom, and it's an object, it's an instrument from my great-grandfather, and it is of irreplaceable value. It's something that if someone stole it, there's no way any amount of money could replace it. Well, as a society, that's true as well. There are resources we have, clean air, clean water, our national parks, for example, where we can't replace them if they're destroyed with just investing in the stock market over that same time period. You couldn't replace the Mona Lisa if it were destroyed, right? It's an irreplaceable heirloom that belongs to all of us. And so for these kinds of resources, I recommend that societies do try to treat them like shared heirlooms. And the national parks are an example of how you can do that. You create institutions, funding, norms, ways to protect them, and then each generation uses them so that those heirlooms become part of the cultural identity of a society. So I think more than we see whole societies that are oriented toward the long term, we see great examples of acting like ancestors and descendants that need to become more prominent and more part of how we think about our own society and its future.
That's Bina Venkatraman. Her new book is The Optimist Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.